Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with James John Bell. James John Bell is an ecological activist. He contributed mightily to our radio endeavor by founding Counter Media in Chicago back in 1996 to provide alternative coverage for the National Democratic Convention, and that contributed to the creation of the Indie Media Centers and the global independent media movement. He works now at the ecological-oriented firm or nonprofit firm Sustain in Chicago and writes widely for ecological publications, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and also has a wonderful website at lastwizards.com, which looks into a variety of topics, including pagan magic, occult philosophy, environmental politics, and technological singularity type issues that we cover often on this show. Welcome, James.
Hello.
Now, the essays that in particular that brought me to your attention were about the connection between your ideas of the singularity and ecological politics, which is an area that most of the kind of libertarian transhumanists and extropians out there have been very suspicious of ecological politics. And you seem to be trying to bring those two topics or interests together. Okay, tell us a little bit. Actually, you just wrote an article for The Futurist, which will be coming out in the May-June issue. What's that article?
Right. The article is called The Post-Human Future, Facing the Technological Singularity. And basically, it explores everything that you just said around the various camps, schools of thought that are forecasting this, you know, technological convergence of epic proportions, and then looks at some of the other camps, like the neo-Luddites, who are very concerned about such happenings. And it looks at both and compares them, and takes you know, the ideas of like Raymond Kurzweil and Bill Joy and you know, lets the reader decide what future they want.
So that'll be the article, Post-Human Future, Facing the Technological Singularity.
Right.
You believe in the singularity, but are you a Luddite? Are you opposed to the singularity?
That's a really good question. I think having worked on issues for a number of years now around technology issues like biotechnology, and trying to get a moratorium placed on biotech research until more health and safety testing is done, has shown me that our society, and in fact the global society, is just not equipped to deal with the regulation and discussion on these issues at the current time, particularly the way that we're set up within a capitalist framework. So you have, for instance, regulations regulating biotechnology that were written 30 to 50 years ago before the technology even existed. And then you have industry groups that are lobbying heavily to keep that being the regulatory framework. And so the banging our head up against the wall that the environmental community has done to try and change that has shown me that, you know, considering the predictions about technological convergence and singularity happening, you know, possibly as soon as 2020 or 2025, and thinking that some kind of regulatory framework could be established or international treaties could be established in order to help the situation and have it come out so that it doesn't do the things that Bill Joy and others have been speculating, that we could, you know, all go the way of Great Goo, has shown me that maybe the best method would be to try and advocate for like a green singularity, you know, some kind of getting the environmental community and getting others to, instead of working on issues that really are somewhat in the past, like biotechnology, and looking at the future and trying to get all of our communities to create visions of a future that we'd like to live in with solar power and utilizing some of these new technologies.
I actually agree with what you're saying here, but let's play devil's advocate for a second. What technology has ever come about fully anticipating, with society fully anticipating the consequences of it and having all the correct policies in place? You know, isn't every technological innovation a matter of chaotic consequences and muddling through with some mistakes and some unintended goods?
Yeah, you could say that, I guess, since the beginning of time, since the first cave folks, banged stones to make tools, that there was probably, some smashed thumbs. So you're right. I think since the beginning, the technology has come, the use of it has come this kind of learning curve, and people have probably gotten hurt in the process. I'm not in any way advocating that people go back to banging rocks. I think that there's definitely a trajectory that's occurring, and with this development of these new technologies, and unless the environmental community, the policy community, the public at large enters into the debate on this stuff, then it's only going to be controlled by the people who have controlled those other technologies, like Monsanto giving us DDT and running all those commercials saying DDT is good for me. Now they have the biotech crops and the Terminator seeds and these various technologies that really only benefit a few individuals, and a lot of us are left out of the dialogue. I'm speaking specifically more about Americans than I am about the rest of the world. Europe and others seem to be a little ahead of the curve in terms of being concerned about such things.
I mean, again, one of the things that could be said on the side of regulation is that these new technologies, as opposed to rocks, being used to bang on other things, these new technologies pose truly apocalyptic threats because of their ability to reproduce, just like nuclear weapons or, people have been worried about the end of the world for a long time, but nuclear weapons actually offer the possibility of the end of the world. So you could argue, and I'm sure you do, that this is a new and qualitatively different threat. But aren't there new and qualitatively different benefits that we also have to be concerned about, for instance, our ability to remediate ecological damage using biotechnology?
Yeah, I've read about some of that, and what I haven't seen yet is it actualized. So until there's some really good examples of it occurring in a laboratory setting or in a controlled experimental setting, it's one thing to talk about golden rice and all these wondrous things and saying biotechnology is going to help feed the world, but from my perspective, working with social and environmental justice groups, it's more a question of distribution than it is a question of the, whether you have some extra vitamins in your bowl of rice. It's actually getting the rice to the people and their ability to create a sustainable economy and a sustainable framework for being able to have access to that type of food on a daily basis. I mean, for instance, in America, there are literally millions of people and many children that go hungry every day. And, biotechnology hasn't been helping them feed Americans. And so maybe the companies in this country should talk about feeding our own homeless and getting rid of that problem before they go off to feed the world.
But you were talking earlier about how you thought that a lot of the problems that are created by biotech and nanotech are because of corporate power and the unaccountable nature of democracy that's dominated by corporate power. No matter what technologies we have, no matter what kinds of social systems we have, if that's the problem, why don't we focus on that instead of the technology? And, for instance, you could imagine that some publicly financed or publicly directed research could lead us to use biotechnology to make crops which require less cropland, fewer pesticides, fewer insecticides, and feed more people, and that would be a good outcome.
And right, and what you have happening currently is a company like, again, to use Monsanto as an example, that makes Roundup Ready soy and corn, and so you actually wind up dousing the crops with more pesticides because they're actually bioengineered to withstand the particular pesticide that's being dumped on them. So I haven't seen it, I guess, and I'm very skeptical, having looked at the history of such technologies and the promises that were made and then the promises kept. I mean, going all the way back for over the last 100 years, you know, you look at nuclear power and the promises that we would all be having, atomic toaster ovens, to the green agricultural green revolution and the promise of all the chemicals. And, you know, we've seen the outcome of those promises and what actually occurred. And then you look at what the current promises are around biotech, and then specifically the latest round of promises around nanotechnology, which promised to kind of clean up the mess that biotech could cause. So there's that parable of the woman who swallowed a fly, and then she swallowed the frog to swallow the fly, and it goes on and on until she swallows the horse to swallow the animal that swallowed this, that swallowed the frog that swallowed the fly, and then she dies. And so that seems to be that kind of chain reaction that we're going through with every new and upcoming technology. You know, we're trying to get back to why we swallowed that fly.
I'm speaking with James John Bell. He's an ecological writer. He's also the director of LastWizards.com, a website that collects and promotes a variety of different emerging science and philosophical ideas around kind of radical ecological vision. Let's talk for a second about the fact that you have written a coda to The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner. And tell us, why were you attracted to Brunner's work?
Well, John Brunner, he was actually a staunch anti-nuclear activist throughout much of his life. And he's a UK author. He's written over 80 science fiction books in his lifetime. He died in 1995. Some of his most well-known work, particularly with this audience of your show, would probably be Shockwave Rider, which he wrote, I believe, in 1975. And Shockwave Rider was really the foundation for the genre to come of cyberpunk. He called Shockwave Rider close-up sci-fi because it was a kind of a description of a near-future world that he was describing. And Shockwave Rider, like a number of his books, looked at America and what was happening with corporate dominance and technological development, particularly issues around overpopulation, environmental issues, issues of surveillance society, which was what Shockwave Rider talked about. And then his books became kind of like manuals for these underground subcultures that he was helping to create. Shockwave Rider was used as a manual to help create the first computer virus when Morris wrote the first worm. I believe it was like 1980s, and that at the time people had speculated that the whole idea of writing a virus in a computer, this is again in the early 70s, was just completely science fiction, that it could never occur, there could never be such an entity, and he was actually ridiculed. And then of course, lo and behold, in the 80s, somebody actually used his book as the inspiration to write that thing. The Sheep Look Up, which is the book that I've written afterward for, takes place in a future militaristic America, in which the President of the United States blames every toxic dump and oil spill and contamination of food not on the companies responsible, but on terrorists. and specifically blames the environmental movement, which has grown to over a million strong because of the widespread pollution and caused by a number of companies. And he does mention them by name, throwing out the creators of DET and these other chemicals. And it is so prescient of today. This book was written in 1972, was carried in the backpacks of many of the founders of today's major environmental organizations, like Brent Blackwelder at Friends of the Earth, and Randy Hayes, who helped found Earth First, and then later Rainforest Action Network. And so this book became somewhat like their guerrilla manual for taking out actions to protect the Earth and to form the first wave in the new environmental movement that was arising after the first Earth Day in 1970.
Literally, guerrilla in the sense that Earth First was one of the organizations, the kind of direct action, in-your-face organizations that were inspired by this kind of work.
Yeah, definitely. And the book, when you read The Sheep Look Up, it's done almanac style, so it's month by month, and it's almost like a diary in that there's just these different kind of snippets that come at you from all directions, news snippets and character snapshots that just whiz by one after the other. And
I remember actually much more vividly Stand on Zanzibar, which was another of Brunner's works, because it's this enormous book, but as the chapters progress, these 10 different storylines are being interwoven by increasingly shorter cutbacks between the different stories until you get to sentence by sentence interweaving of the 10 different stories or so. It really gave you the sense of the kind of acceleration up to some climactic point.
Yes, and that interwoven quality really lets you experience and become a part of the world that Brunner is creating, because he doesn't like explain the slang, he doesn't explain those kind of nuances. You just sort of hear it like you would have, you know, gotten off a plane into a new city, and you're just kind of immersed in this new environment, and you have to sort of figure it out as you go and learn from the characters themselves, and that really helps immerse oneself in the world that he's creating. Same with The Sheep Look Up. John Brunner does the same thing, where at first there's all these divergent plot lines, and as you get towards the end, the book becomes harder and harder to put down as they begin to coalesce and come together. And particularly with The Sheep Look Up, it has, and I won't give it away, but it is a very a horrific and a apocalyptic end to that tale.
Well, it turns out that an allegedly organic produce seller is actually polluted in some way, or genetically engineered in some way.
Right. There's a couple different aspects, which is really amazing and prescient of today, in that the largest food company, Puritan Foods, is advertising and selling their food as wholesome and healthy, and the radical environmentalists in the story are secretly testing their food to find out if it is in fact safe. And what they find is literally the tip of the iceberg. And because of that, they're hunted by like a kind of the mafia of this capitalistic America, because their information could destroy the credibility around this food company. In a very amazing parallel to this story, Friends of the Earth and the Genetic Engineering Food Alert Coalition have been secretly testing the food from Kraft Foods and have found out that it contains a number of genetically engineered ingredients, all of which, of course, are unlabeled. And when they did the original testing back in 2000, this was when they discovered that Taco Bell taco shells put out by Kraft Foods were contained Starlink, which was a unapproved corn for human consumption. And because of that, over 300 food products had to be recalled because of the potential to create allergies in people. and it really sent a shockwave through the biotechnology industry. And in fact, investors pulled out to the order of something like $10 billion dropped because of that disaster. Now, the GE Food Alert Coalition and these other groups like Greenpeace and a number of scientific organizations have been warning that because we don't have any regulations on the growing of biotech drug crops, this is where we bioengineer various vaccines and other pharmaceuticals into a corn or into a tobacco crop or into a soybean to mass produce that pharmaceutical and then harvest it and take out the particular vaccine or whatever it is we're growing, that because those experimental plots are out in the open, that they could be potentially contaminating nearby crops, or you know, somebody with bad intentions could literally drive up and take a number of these crops and the seeds of those crops and take them somewhere else because there are no security on those sites, at least in this country.
I'm speaking with James John Bell, and he's talking right now about the upcoming reprint of The Sheep Look Up, which will be coming out from Ben Bella Books, in which he has a coda that describes the various ways in which our contemporary society faces the same kind of ecological challenges that were described in The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner. Let's go back to Earth First for a second. Earth First is an example inspired by deep ecological philosophy of what a lot of transhumanists are anxious about in the ecological movement, a certain misanthropy on the part of perceived misanthropy on the part of ecological activists, which not only transhumanists are concerned about, but some other ecological activists, environmental writers have written about. A kind of extremism that technology should be banned as opposed to regulated and therefore, you know, not get any of the good benefits of technology, but only eliminate the bad. And a concern about terrorist action or actions which, at least terrorist against property, if not against people. You've been involved with Earth First on and off, and my interest in the fact that you are concerned about the singularity in nanotechnology is combined with a tinge of concern that Earth First's attention to protecting logging by spiking trees might now extend to blowing up nanotechnology labs.
Well, I don't think that you could compare tree spiking with blowing anything up, just because of the nature of one activity being fairly benign and known people have ever died from the act of tree spiking, and the other obviously being extremely destructive. Earth First, for the most part, particularly in areas in the Northwest where tree spiking was causing a rift between the logging community that Earth Firsters were trying to organize in and their own environmental organizations and goals, disavowed spiking of trees, which actually caused a split years ago between Earth First and others who wanted to take more extreme forms of action. And that split happened in Europe, in the UK, and that was where the Earth Liberation Front came off of. And so whereas Earth First had somewhat kind of dropped the monkey wrench, so to speak, ELF came out of the trees and picked it up.
It was also part of Earth First having been in a dialogue with social justice activists, and these social justice activists were convincing them that they had to engage with mass movements like labor as opposed to simply piss them off.
Right, and I think having known some of those folks and actually participated in direct action with women like Judy Berry and men like Daryl Turney, the strategy was a very smart one in that if there was going to be tree spiking occurring or there was going to be sabotage of a logging mill or something occurring, that it was in the best interest of the movements at hand for the workers themselves to carry out that act. In fact, that's one of the things that always gets misrepresented when people talk about Earth First and this and women like Judy Berry disavowing monkey wrenching, was that was that they weren't disavowing that nobody does monkey wrenching. They were disavowing that outsiders, outside activists coming into a community would do any kind of sabotage, that what outside activists would do would be educate people about working conditions, about labor relations, about the economy and what the true intentions of some of these mega corporations were in terms of moving jobs down to Mexico and elsewhere for less environmental regulations and for less labor costs, etc. That the workers themselves, on hearing and understanding and educating themselves, would be moved to take action against their own employer, and that they would be the ones engaging in actions. In terms of your concern about Earth Firsters, sabotaging nanotech labs, I wouldn't see it coming from the Earth First movement. If anything, the Earth First movement is educating the farming community around things like biotechnology. And to give that example, I think what you may see is that if it indeed winds up that biopharmaceuticals and other drugs, drug crops contaminate conventional farm or organic farm crops, that the farmers themselves would go out and symbolically sabotage their fields. They would just burn their own fields, and call the media and say, I'm torching my conventional crop because it was contaminated with that lab 7 miles down the way that's growing this pig vaccine, and that it wouldn't be Earth Firsters who would engage in those activities. Earth Firsters would have been the ones who educated them, who hooked them up with scientists to help test their crops to find out what happened, and were working the media relations to try and get media attention to the plight of such and such farmer.
I hope that that's what's happening. I mean, I think that some people have a concern that middle-class, first-world environmental activists are attempting to protect, for instance, Indian farmers from bioengineered crops, which could potentially feed a lot more Indians, but because of these first worlders' anxieties about bioengineering, that they're trying to get them banned or trying to convince their governments not to allow them in, and leading to situations like countries in Africa where people are starving, not allowing their people to eat bioengineered crops. So I think they're still concerned with environmental activists having a misanthropic or not being sufficiently engaged with the actual day-to-day needs of the people that they're trying to protect.
And I think in that case, you're right. I've read a number of letters to the editor and elsewhere that have said something very similar, that, it's a very emotional issue.
I've been speaking with James John Bell. He's an environmental writer and activist. He has the cover story in the forthcoming May-June issue of The Futurist, an article titled Post-Human Future Facing the Technological Singularity. He's got a coda to a forthcoming reissue of The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner, which I highly recommend both as a novel and his coda. And you can find out more about his work at lastwizards.com, where he talks about science, media, magic, philosophy, and environmental politics. Thanks so much for joining us today, James.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.